lips look delicious.
My brother will be there at the
waves
door.
Upon a tropical shore.
My maiden aunt's mine.
You are listening to radio.dominican.edu. Tonight, David Plouffe.
Hello. Welcome. I'm Elaine Petrocelli from Book Passage, and on behalf of the magnificent team at Dominican and the Dominican Leadership Institute and Dr. Denise Lucy and all of the Book Passage staff, including our events director, Karen West, I want to say hi. I'm so glad you're here. I've been waiting for tonight. I don't know about you, but I thought he was writing only to me. And then I found out that he wrote to a lot of people, and we all responded. I have a couple of quick announcements. The first one is, don't do what I did in the movies during the love scene. Please turn off your cell phone. And tonight's event is being recorded, and you can tell your friends who miss it that they can go to radio.dominican.edu and listen to tonight's talk. So thank you for the Dominican radio station for doing that. They can hear it anywhere in the world. We have great outreach. I'd also like to invite you to fill out the survey form that has been passed out. It helps us to do better lectures and respond better to the kinds of things you would like to have. And at the bottom, there is a place where you may, if you'd like, give information. And if you do, we'll contact you, and you'll be one of the first to know about what we're doing. And you can also find those things out on the Book Passage website, bookpassage.com. And one of the things that you are getting to find out about before very many people, other than the 1,200 people who squeezed in here Monday night to hear Vice President Gore, we are just announcing that Elizabeth Gilbert will be here on the 27th of January. Tickets are $40, and you can get tickets either by going to bookpassage.com, by calling the store, or coming in. The ticket includes a book. And I know that she was recently at Civic Center to a sold-out crowd, and the ticket was $40, but you didn't get a book. So we're a really good deal. Now I am going to turn this go away for a moment and give you a chance to turn off your cell phones before we start the evening's events. Thanks. Oh, I should tell you, after the event, you are going to want to buy more books. We are going to come up on stage, and the ushers will help us come up a row at a time so you can sit and relax while the ushers bring you up. But if you should decide that this will be a great present for someone or you need it for your library, the booksellers are right over here. And one of the things we've noticed at this event is that people always give you your place back in line, so don't feel it in any hesitation to say, I'll be right back, I need more books, because we love that. Thank you so much.
You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. Just getting ready for David Plouffe on Wednesday, the 11th. Oh, here's Denise Lucy right now to talk more about tonight's speaker.
Thank you, Elaine. Welcome to Dominican University of California. Who is here on Monday night? Fantastic. So wonderful to have you back in our great auditorium. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm the director of the Institute for Leadership Studies, and it is my privilege to welcome you this evening and to thank our sponsors, who, of course, begin with Book Passage. Without Book Passage, what would we do here in Marin? It is an amazing gem. Thank you so much, Book Passage. And I also want to say thank you so much to Penguin Viking Books, because without their support, we could also not host this event. So please do buy that book for a friend for the holidays. I also want to thank a sponsor tonight, EarthSight, for being one of our donor sponsors. Thank you so much, our guests here from EarthSight. Please patronize EarthSight. And, of course, Marin Magazine, our ongoing friend, whom has just given us so much support as our media sponsor over this last couple of years. Thank you so much, Marin Magazine. So it is my pleasure to invite the Honorable Susan Adams, who will be introducing our speaker. Dr. Adams is the first district of Marin County Board of Supervisors, which includes our community here at Dominican. Dr. Adams is deeply committed to the concept of healthy planet and healthy people and is working with her community to make it happen. So I'd like you to please welcome Dr. Susan Adams, who will introduce our distinguished speaker. Thank you.
You're listening to radio.dominican.edu.
Thank you, Dr. Lucy. It's such a pleasure to be here with all of you tonight. A famous philosopher and an old baseball great, Yogi Berra, once said, "If you don't know where you're going, you might end up somewhere else." Our guest tonight knew where he was going and has had a fascinating career. David Plouffe was the 2008 presidential campaign manager for Barack Obama's winning and most incredible presidential run to the United States. David Plouffe served as the campaign manager for Barack Obama's primary and general election victories. He was the architect of the strategy for both elections. President Obama praised Mr. Plouffe as the unsung hero of the presidential campaign who built the best political campaign in the history of the United States of America. Mr. Plouffe has changed the campaign world forever. The Chicago Tribune wrote, "David Plouffe was the mastermind behind a winning strategy. He also maintained discipline over communications in the campaign, including controlling leaks and releasing information about the campaign on its terms. His Plouffe pieces were masterful. Averse to publicity himself, his control over the internal workings of the Obama campaign successfully avoided the publicly aired squabbles that frequently trouble other campaigns. Mr. Plouffe has had the extraordinary successes in his campaign career, which began in 1990. Prior to running the Obama campaign, Mr. Plouffe served as a leading Democratic Party media consultant from 2001 until 2007, playing a key role in the election of U.S. senators, governors, mayors, and House members across the country. As campaign director for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, he led a national campaign that brought the Democrats closer to a majority. His first book, The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory, was just released a week ago. It chronicles the arrival of a new moment in American life at the convergence of digital technology and grassroots organization. The book also reveals how the campaign functioned and grew as a billion-dollar startup with laser-like focus and discipline. It is our good fortune that he is here with us tonight to share his insights on that groundbreaking achievement, taking inside the remarkable campaign that led to the election of the first African-American president. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to help me welcome the man who made the audacity of hope a reality, Mr. David Plouffe.
That was very nice. Thank you. Wow. Well, thank you, everybody. That is definitely, by the way, that's very kind of you. That picture, by the way, is before the second presidential debate in Belmont University, about 15 minutes before it started, and before Barack Obama went out and scored a convincing victory in debate number two. Well, listen, you're great to be here tonight. I think we're going to have time for some discussion. And so I thought that, listen, when we get into discussion, we can talk about any of the great characters from the campaign. Reverend Wright or Bill Ayers or Joe the Plumber or my good friend Sarah Palin, who will be She taped her Oprah interview today, by the way, and it's running Monday, and I think it will be must-watch television. And obviously, any of the ins and outs of the campaign, anything that's on your mind about politics and communication today. But rather than just kind of go back through a memory lane tour of 2008, I thought I'd spend my time talking to you about some of the key, I think, threads that run through the book and that ran through our campaign, some of which I think are applicable outside politics even, in terms of the new world we live in today. Now, I'll start with this. One of the reasons we won is we defied convention in ways big and small in the campaign. We did not have a dusty playbook on the shelf about how we or anyone should run for president in 2008, largely because Barack Obama got into this race very unconventionally. Almost everybody who runs for president in both parties who's serious about it spends years and years planning about it, thinking about it, doing all the things you need to do. We didn't do that. Now, and I will say this, that book in your hands, or hopefully it will be in your hands soon, will be a dusty playbook in 2012, too. And I hope the Republicans follow it, because I assure you we will chart a new course. There were a few things I had to leave out of the book, so don't worry about that. But most everything's in there, because our world and our politics and our technology is changing so rapidly. But that's an important thing to understand. And one of the things that courses throughout the book and courses throughout our campaign was probably the thing that was hardest for us to do and least understood. Barack Obama would have not been the Democratic nominee. In fact, he probably would have had to drop out shortly after Iowa. And in a close race, we would have lost to John McCain if we had not tried to and ultimately successfully changed the electorate. And that's a really hard thing to do. In most elections, whether it's mayor, governor, senator, president, roughly the same people or the same types of people come out to vote every 4 years. And when we got into this race, we knew, and you'll read a lot about Iowa in the book. I'll be there tomorrow. I can't wait to go back. It'll be like a homecoming. Iowa was everything to us. We did not think that we could win the election against Hillary Clinton unless we beat her in the first contest. And one thing that was a strength about us in the campaign, and I would argue it's a strength in his presidency, and I think it'll serve the country very well, is we determined what our strategy was, what our message was, essentially what our theory of success was, and we committed to it. We committed to it. And we did not arrogantly know or believe it was necessarily going to work. I can't tell you the number of times Barack Obama said, I'm not sure if this is going to work, if people were accept me or my message or our Iowa strategies right. But it's the one we've committed to, so we're going to throw everything we have at it. Little problem with that is that if the people who turned out in the Kerry Edwards Dean Gephardt race of 2004 or the Gore Bradley race of 2000 or every Iowa caucus going back to Jimmy Carter showed up, there was no way we could even finish better than third place. We just couldn't. We had to make the electorate in Iowa younger and in a big way. And we had to bring independents and Republicans in, which was hard because they had to change their voter registration in front of their neighbors on caucus night. And we had to make it more diverse. And that's what we set out to do. And you had to have a candidate, obviously. You know, this is all about the candidate. So someone who's never gone to a caucus before is not going to go unless they have some interest in, some affection for, some belief in the candidate. But getting people to go to a caucus is awfully darn hard. It's hard to get people to go to a primary, too. Caucus is about 10 times harder than that. So you had to organize, and that's what we set out doing. We organized high schools all throughout Iowa. In some cases, that meant getting three or four kids from a little rural high school to go to their caucus. But the way the caucus works, that can make a difference. And so every day in Iowa, we didn't necessarily look at what the polls said. By the way, this is true of the entire campaign, and it's true of his presidency. Don't pay attention to them. Or aware of them, or not guided by them. We paid attention to, were we accomplishing our goal of changing the electorate in Iowa? It wasn't just our support level. How many people were supporting us? How many volunteers we had? Were we on a trajectory to allow us to do that? And on caucus night, historically, people over the age of 65 turned out at twice the rate of people under 30 in every Iowa caucus. And on the night of January 3rd, more people turned out under 30 than over 65. That's the most remarkable statistic of the election. And it's why we won. And in primary and caucus after that, the states we did well in, even the states we lost in, like California, but we kept the delegate margin down. It was because we changed who participated in the election. And one thing that you'll learn when you read this book was that Iowa was our laboratory. Almost everything you saw on the rest of the campaign was either because it worked or didn't work in Iowa. And we took that forward. And changing the electorate was a fundamental part of our general election strategy against John McCain. With the belief that presidential campaigns in the modern era are close, we lived through two close ones in 2000 and 2004, and the best thing we could do to improve our success was to change who was turning out. And so that's what we set out to do in the general election. Some of you volunteered on the campaign. You went to Nevada. You went to other states. You made phone calls. A lot of that was geared towards making sure that we had historic young turnout and historic African-American turnout, and we registered 6 million new people. And that's what we did. And on election day of 2008, amongst the people who voted in the Bush-Kerry race, here was the results. Barack Obama, 50%. John McCain, 49%. Coin flip. We've seen that movie before. You don't know how the Electoral College will turn out. But amongst those people who voted in their first election for president, or the first election in a long time, meaning people who had checked out of politics, and there's tens of millions of them in this country, we won 71-27. And I don't think you'll ever see that number again in American politics, to have that big of an advantage. So, defying convention. When I talk about that, that is probably the central feature of that. We defied convention in many other ways. The belief that young people would turn out. That volunteers actually could not just be a nice addition to a campaign, but they could be core to it. That you do not run your campaign or evaluate its progress based on political commentary or punditry. That you have to have your own internal metrics. And that's hard to do, by the way. It's not fun to wake up and read the newspaper every day or turn on TV and people saying, you don't know what you're doing, you're off track, you know, you need to course correct. And sometimes we did need to course correct. But see, in the presidential campaign, and I felt bad for a lot of you who are witnessing the campaign, because you would watch TV or you would read stuff online or read the newspaper, and in many respects, they were evaluating a different campaign than the one we were running. See, we had our own radar. I and the staff I worked with on this knew in every state, North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, Virginia, exactly what we thought it took to win, exactly, to the person. How many new registrations, African-American turnout, young turnout, how we needed to deal with post-college graduate women between the ages of 25 and 50, with senior blue-collar men in the Roanoke, Virginia market. And because we had so many volunteers talking to all those voters, every day we knew how we were doing. And that's what mattered to us. That was our Bible. And that discipline is something that's a hallmark of the president, and it's a hallmark today on health care. All he cares about is getting the votes in Congress for a plan that meets his principles, not whether we won the war on CNN today. And people still don't understand that about him. And it's unique leadership qualities, particularly in that town of Washington that is so small and petty and political. To think long-term, to think strategically, is something that I think will serve the country well. So that courses through the campaign, that we are a metrics-driven campaign. And we talk a lot of time and effort to establish those metrics. Some of the other principles are obviously what our grassroots volunteers meant to us. And, you know, one thing, everybody assumes this was just some brilliant campaign strategy we came up with. Okay? It was not. It started as a dictate from Barack Obama, who said, I am going to run a grassroots campaign because I think too many people are disconnected, disengaged from our country and our politics, and so I want to get them involved. That's where this started. And obviously, as we got into the campaign, it became clear that, hey, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, they have political support everywhere. We have political support nowhere. So we actually did need volunteers. That's all we had. But from the very beginning of the campaign, we based strategic decisions on that. And we thought our volunteers could do three very important things. And then there was a fourth we did not anticipate. The first was obviously eventually to help fund our campaign. And one thing I write in the book is in the first two quarters of 07, when we raised a lot of money, and that was very important because Hillary was running as the inevitable candidate. But most of that money didn't come from the grassroots. It came from traditional sources. But there was a big tension in the campaign because our fundraising staff, rightly, were saying, hey, Pluff, you're asking us to raise $25 million this quarter, but you're not asking the people in the email list for money very often. But we did that by design because we wanted our relationship to be broad-based, that yes, we would ask for money occasionally, but we wanted to just communicate sometime without asking for anything. And we certainly wanted people to volunteer. And so eventually, obviously, the grassroots did fund our campaign. We raised $750 million, and $500 million of that came online. 4 million people gave us money, average contribution, $85. Top two categories of donors, not lobbyists, not lawyers, not even business people, it was retirees and students. Remarkable thing to see. People giving $5, $10, $25, it was hard to give. And the money mattered. I actually met someone at the reception earlier who said they gave money because of a video we sent out where I talked about our Florida budget. As just one example, some of you guys might remember this. We said, hey, we're asking you guys for all this time and all this money. We want to show one state so you understand. And here's our Florida budget. And here's what we're spending the money on. The real budget, by the way. And it was one of the best things we did because people felt, okay, I understand I'm not giving money to a black hole. These guys really think they need $38 million to win Florida. And here's how they're spending their money. So, and one thing I write a lot about in the book is most of the media, and fortunately John McCain, never understood what we were doing. We were trying to build, and we did, the most muscular, strategic, smartest, and aggressive battleground state campaigns in the history of presidential politics. So that the campaigns themselves, the Virginia campaign, the Nevada campaign, the Ohio campaign, on their own, almost separate and apart from what was going on nationally, could deliver victories for us. And that's what this all went for. But the money part of this gets almost all the attention. It was the two other parts of the campaign that some of you participated in that made all the difference. The second thing was it organized the campaign. Well, what does that mean? Well, obviously, we went from about nobody to 13 million people. Of course, some people just came in on their own through the website. But a lot of people got involved because our supporters on the ground were saying, hey, you need to get involved in this campaign. Sign up on the website. Come to the office. Campaign. So they built the campaign. And when we talk about registering voters, almost all of that was done by our volunteers. Almost all of it. And when we talk about changing the electorate, yeah, we had a good strategy, and we had a candidate who made that possible. But we always thought the reason a 45-year-old African-American man from Philadelphia was most likely to vote for the first time in his life was because his friend or his family member said, I'm going to register to vote for the first time in my life and vote for President Barack Obama. You should too. The most likely reason a 24-year-old who never expressed any interest in politics, never voted, came down to the Obama campaign office for the first time was usually because their friend or family member asked them to do it. So that's how we expanded the electorate, was person by person. And that leads into probably the most powerful thing that our grassroots campaign did for us that the media and our opponents still don't understand, is it was the most effective and powerful and authentic way to communicate our message. Okay? We live in a much different world than we even did 10 years ago. There are huge segments of this country that never watch cable news, broadcast news, read the newspaper. And some of them don't even get information online. It's really hard to reach people. And what we were able to do is really by the fall, we had created a list of 13 million people in this country. Think about that. We built our own television network. We reached more people when we sent an email in the campaign and today than on any night watch NBC News and all the cable channels combined in the evening, including my friends at Fox. Think about that. With direct messaging. Many times videos directly from President Obama or candidate Obama. So you get the message. You consume it. And then you share it. Many people forward them. Others just internalize it. The value of that in the campaign could not have been overstated. And it's very valuable today as we deal with things like health care. And in the campaign, we knew we were going to get attacked. We knew it was going to be harsh and character-based. And we thought on a day when Sarah Palin would say, Barack Obama does not see America like you or I do. He's palling around with terrorists. As silly as that was, it was something that had to be dealt with. And what we thought was that more important than what Barack Obama said about that day, or Joe Biden, or something like I said it about that day, was what our volunteers said about it. Because they were going to be knocking doors that night, and they were going to be talking to four undecided swing voters on their block in Anderson, Indiana. And that person, that undecided voter, would say, hey, what about this thing Sarah Palin said about Bill Ayers? And our volunteer would say, let me tell you the truth about that. And let me tell you why John McCain's running that kind of campaign, because he doesn't have any ideas on the economy. Okay? That is, I don't need to tell you the power of that. Human beings talking to human beings, interestingly enough, in the age of technology, is growing in import. It's what people trust. And this isn't just my opinion. We researched this very thoroughly. It's what they trust. There's a lack of trust in the media and in government and in even some academic institutions, sorry, faith institutions, business institutions. What people trust is their family members, their friends, even though they know that a lot of those people aren't issue experts or policy experts. They trust their values and kind of the way they see things. So that's what we built, was the ability to communicate directly. And with technology, obviously, we could, with a push of one button, get a message out to 13 million people so they were current on the campaign as Barack Obama was. And that was a very, very powerful thing. And obviously, technology allowed that to happen. Technology was at the center of our campaign, as was the grassroots. You cannot talk about one without the other. Most people came to the campaign through the website. Many people raised money for us through the website. Many people organized their communities long before we ever set foot in their state or community using social networking technology. Many people made phone calls remotely using our website. Now, most of the really, really important organizing activity in battleground states was done offline, but the organizing for those activities was done online. And many people got all of their information online. And there's a phenomenon out there. We all do this in our lives, right? We see a YouTube video we like or a news story we like. We email it to our friends and family members. That's what was happening in the election, right? You had this guerrilla kind of email campaign going on. You know, Barack Obama doesn't salute the American flag, or Barack Obama's this, or Barack Obama's that. And we had to arm our supporters with the ability to defend that, which is why we started a site called fightthesmears.com, so people could respond to that. And, you know, it's interesting in politics. There used to be an adage saying, well, if someone's attacked you or there's something in the ether, but it hasn't led the news or been on the front page of the paper, you should not acknowledge it because you don't want to elevate it. Well, that's kind of a 1960s mentality, because it may not be on the news, but it can be in 50 million people's email boxes by the end of the day. So you better deal with it, because that's how politics works these days. And so many of people get their information that way, not from the news. And this is only going to explode more. It's not going to be in the too distant future. I don't think it's 12. It could be 16. It could be 20. But what we did in the campaign, sending emails to people that they watched on their computers or their laptops, is going to seem like Jurassic Park. Because almost everybody is going to be watching videos and doing their emails on personal devices. And who knows, by then it could be in holograms. I don't know. But it's going to change rapidly. And for a campaign, actually, that tried to get people involved, you know, I salivated that, because we could actually send messages out to people, and rather being tethered to a desk, they could be walking down the street and say, hey, I'm going to share this with the 500 people in my address book. Or walking down the street and say, oh, the Obama office 5 blocks from now just sent out a message saying that they're short 4 canvassers. I'll go. You know, I mean, it's going to be a remarkable, I think, explosion in participatory democracy that hopefully we as a party can be ahead of. So technology played such a fundamental role in our campaign, and I talk about that a lot in the book because I think that there was some misperceptions about how we use technology. And we used it as a central way to deliver message. And I think there's two important points I mentioned in the book about communication. One is, in the world we live in today, if you're trying to reach people, whether you're a political campaign, an auto company, you know, somebody selling a new brand of cereal, you can't just be in one space or 2 spaces or 3 spaces. You've got to be in all spaces, and that's what we try to be in the campaign. If you are a swing voter in Roanoke, Virginia, we were on your television broadcast. We bought cable. We did on-demand programs. You could sit and watch a 7 or 8 minute documentary about the Virginia economy and what Barack Obama is going to do about it. We were all over the radio dial, including faith radio and radio geared towards hunters, hunter and fisher and sportsmen and women, went after McCain on his ground. We tried to be all over the internet with very, very targeted internet advertising. We tried to be in your email box. We tried to be on your landline. We tried to be at your door. We tried to be at your community center. We tried to be at the soccer field. We tried to be everywhere because you never know when you're going to capture someone and have their attention. And that's hard to do, but it's what you have to do. And McCain left some of those unguarded, particularly the doors and the on-demand and a lot of the ground stuff. Now, when you do that, you've got to be in alignment. And this is one of the hardest things we did in the campaign. It doesn't do any good for Barack Obama to go into Cleveland, Ohio, and give a speech on health care, and the TV ads on energy, and our door knockers talking about tax cuts. We've lost a huge opportunity, much less we look highly disorganized. You've got to compound your message. And this is something that was hard, and there's days we failed at it. But we tried to make sure that we were firing on all cylinders. So that if we said, this is the week we're going on the offensive on health care, and we're going to contrast our health care plan with McCain's, well, the speeches of Obama and Biden, every surrogate, every TV ad, every internet ad, every radio ad, every door knock script, every phone script had to be on that. And you just put all your chips on that. And that was really, really important. I think that's an important message about you have to do that today. We live in a fractured environment in terms of information. If you are not leveraging all your assets in one direction, you're going to miss an opportunity. So, last thing I'd say, and then we can get into some questions, is one thing that courses throughout the book is obviously the performance of our candidate and the culture he created. And I didn't want to spend a lot of time talking to you today about the things that the media likes to obsess about, Reverend Wright and the VP pick and, you know, Bill Ayers. I'm sure we'll get into that in questions. But he was at his best and at his calmest during our lowest moments. You might expect me to say that, but it's the truth. And whether it was most of the latter 3 or 4 months of 2007, where, you know, there's a kind of a mythology out there that says the National Press Corps picked Barack Obama up on their shoulders and marched him to the White House. Well, I get very angry when I hear that. But actually, I had to do some research. I wouldn't even say research. I had to do some confirmatory research in writing of this book. And if you look at the press coverage of September, October, November of 2007, you would come to a much different conclusion. Because it was, this guy's out of steam, he's dead in the water, he can't win. Okay? He's got this goofy Iowa strategy, he's probably not going to win Iowa, but even if he does, he's 20, 30 points down. What does it matter? Okay? Now, we thought we saw something no one else saw, which is we thought the race would change if we won Iowa, and that in many respects, we weren't going to be the plucky underdog. See, this is something everybody missed. We weren't Johnny One Note at that point. We were in the beginning. We didn't know how much money we were going to raise or how much grassroots support we'd have in volume. So it really was, well, we have to try and win Iowa, and then Lord knows how, but we'll have to piece together enough money and resources to compete later. But what happened was, by the middle of 07, as you recall, we had raised more money than Hillary Clinton, and we had much stronger grassroots support. We became a very dangerous force. And someone in the Clinton campaign after the election said something very smart. Said, we should have realized at that moment that this guy was like Secretariat. By the way, I talked about Secretariat in the campaign one day, and all the kids around me said, Secretariat, what? So, but some of you understand who Secretariat was. And they said, we should have understood he was like Secretariat. He was a thoroughbred. We could not afford to let him out of the gate. And the gate was Iowa. See, because we had become so strong and powerful around the country that if we could just win Iowa, we weren't just an underdog that would have to put a few nickels together and see how we could do it. We could maximize that momentum. But in the fall, no one gave us a chance. And he deserves enormous credit for saying, we are sticking to this strategy. It very well may not win. That's hard to do when your fundraisers, your political supporters, even some of your staff say, you're on the wrong track. You've got to fight through that. When we lost the New Hampshire primary, which was probably the most devastating moment of the campaign to us, because I can assure you, the Obama playbook about how to become president did not include losing the New Hampshire primary. He was at his best that night, the next morning, and sent the message loud and clear, even saying that, I think this may be for the best. I write this in the book. I travel with him down to Boston the next morning. He said, I think this might be for the best, because if I had won this, not a guarantee, but I was like a rocket in the sky. I'm the undeniable Democratic frontrunner. And I've kind of come out of nowhere. And so I'm going to be like a pinata for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I think people want to see me earn this. And, you know, my reaction was, you're in serious denial, dude. I mean, that sounds good. But I thought, I think he really believes it. And I thought that was important because his demeanor and his ability to fight through that and lead us through it was really important. Reverend Wright, of course, something that was not as catastrophic as New Hampshire just because we had become at that point the front runner, but still quite damaging, obviously. The only way we were able to navigate through it was his decision to give a very, very unconventional speech that I can assure you the political playbook said should not be done. You don't elevate your problems. You try and run from them. And he wrote a beautiful speech. And he got us through that. And I think even during the period in August when, you know, all the national press thought McCain was brilliant, calling us an empty celebrity and we're Britney Spears and Paris Hilton, he was very good about staying the course and believing that wasn't working. And during the economic crisis anyway. You know, and by the way, obviously the economy was something that was atmospherically helpful to us simply because people wanted to change from Bush. But listen, when Lehman collapsed, it wasn't just that fact alone that impacted the campaign. It's how these two candidates dealt with it. Okay, and so McCain says the fundamentals of our economy are strong. We should suspend our campaign, whatever that is, and not debate. And Obama says a president has to do more than one thing at a time. One of us is going to be president in a few weeks. What signal does it send to the American people if we panic and don't debate? And so the way they dealt with this, and again, a lot of these things I'm talking about, these weren't polled. These weren't debated ad nauseum. They were gut instincts. They were decisions. They were judgments, the kind of thing presidents have to make all the time. And I think for those of us involved in the campaign, like David Axelrod, Robert Gibbs, myself, who had been there from the beginning, we began to feel some obligation that we needed to win this election because we really thought this guy had some unique leadership abilities and traits that the country would need as things got more and more deteriorating out there in terms of the economy. So he really led us through this. And I think the culture of the campaign, though, went down from Barack Obama all the way to the volunteers. Because I think our volunteers really believed that he valued them, that he understood their role in the campaign, that he trusted them. And that kind of culture, even in the campaign office, I mean, this is going to sound like kumbaya, but I do think that, you know, any organization, whether it be a campaign for the presidency of the United States, a university, a business, even a family, is a collection of human beings. And how those human beings relate and trust each other or don't and understand the mission is going to be so central to the success. And we were a campaign of people who largely got along, not a lot of yelling and screaming, but a lot of intensity. And that mattered a great deal because presidential campaigns can be almost intolerable in the best of circumstances. But when there is leaking, and when there's a lack of trust, and when there's dissension about the mission, and when the candidate is one who's kind of second-guesses decisions and kind of lashes out. And I will tell you one thing about Barack Obama is, and I write about this in the book, he is self-aware to a degree that I find unusual in any human being, much less someone at the pinnacle of politics. And when you are in something like this, I can't tell you how important it is when you say, okay, well, we're kind of in a rough patch here, so how are we going to improve? And rather than pointing fingers first, he starts with an assessment of his own performance. And it's always dead on. You know, I have my secret list of things he could be doing better, and he always ticked them off one by one. So I didn't really have to get to them in front of everybody. And that was remarkable. So there was an esprit de corps and a trust that was remarkable. And going back to the volunteers, I mentioned there was four things that they really did for us. And the fourth thing was something that has nothing to do with programmatic activity or metrics. I can't tell you how many times Barack Obama, in both primary and general, after getting off a conference call with our volunteers, he would meet a lot of times with our volunteers. You know, he flies into a state to do a rally. Before the rally, he'd meet with our core volunteer leaders. He would say, I do not want to let those people down. And during our toughest moments, as he led us out of it, so did our volunteers. we lose the New Hampshire primary. It gets called, I probably remember it to the moment, but, 11-0-7, 11-10, or whatever it is. In the hour after we are declared the loser of the New Hampshire primary, we raised exponentially more money than we'd ever raised before. And the message that sent to us was, these people are in it for the long haul. They have our back. And time again, when we'd have tough moments, and we had a lot of them, we would say, we can't really afford to get down here, or because there's millions of people out there who miraculously are finding time they do not have to give and money they cannot afford to give to make this campaign happen. And I can't tell you how motivating that was and how inspirational it was. So our grassroots volunteers, in many respects, also lifted the entire campaign up, including our candidate, at moments of great challenge. So, those are some of the bigger principles that course throughout the book. There's plenty of how we dealt with Wright and the mistakes we made, and, there's ad nauseum about Palin. I'm sure you guys will ask me about that. I'd be happy to talk about it. But I think some of those principles, what I tried to do here is not just write a book. It's in narrative form, but it's not what happened. It's why it happened. And a lot of discussion about our opponents, because I happen to believe in politics, you should spend more time running your opponent's race than your own. Because this is a comparative exercise. You have to understand what you think they're going to do. If they don't do it, why they didn't do it, what their next step is. Politics, or at least at the presidential level, which is a very complex affair, is very much like chess. And it's interesting, the Clinton campaign made some strategic errors. But, she was a great candidate. They put us through her paces. It was like playing chess. Whenever the Clintons tried to get us in an engagement, we could never leap in. We had to say, okay, well, they've made this move. So then, if we make this move, what's their next move? And kind of, where are they trying to take this to? Where's this all going to end? That's what it's like. And so that's what we were conditioned to do. And so when we first got into our engagement with McCain, after we wrapped up the nomination in June, we were conditioned to do that. But with McCain, there would always be just one move. And it was, I must tell you, rather than kind of high-fiving about that, we were kind of disappointed because we're like, come on, this is for the presidency of the United States. So in many respects, that's just one. The long primary served us well. So anyway, with that, I know that's just kind of a cook's tour of some of the things in the book and the campaign, but we're happy to take some questions now.
Wow. Well, I have lots of questions here, and I'm going to combine a couple of them because they're on the same subject. They're really about how the challenges of now governing compare to the challenges of the campaign. And as one person said, I feel as if we're still in the campaign. The other side is fighting. Sarah Palin is still campaigning. How do we make sure that we're able to govern now?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I was on the Ron Owens show this morning, and he was playing some clips of Obama speeches all the way back from the Springfield announcement to our very last rally in Virginia. And what's remarkable is the consistency of why the president ran and what he's trying to do right now. And at its core was his belief that particularly on issues of energy and health care, and to some degree education, Washington was failing the country. That if we continued on this course and continued to spend twice as much money on health care as our competitors, and we allow China and India really to lead on energy, technology, and jobs, so that we led industrial revolution, we led information revolution, we don't lead in this one, we're going to be in big, big trouble. It is not written in history or written in stone that the United States of America remains as strong as we are or have been. Many of you are readers. You don't have to read too many history books to understand that strong countries and in the old days empires that did not renew themselves atrophy, and they do not remain strong. And his view was Washington had been incapable of dealing with these long-term challenges. And so what we're seeing now is he is obviously trying to triage a short-term economic crisis, the likes of which we've only seen one other time in our country. And if he hadn't done some tough things, really tough things, the Recovery Act, the things he had to do on auto and banks, I can assure you last year when we were in the campaign talking about the first year of the Obama administration, it did not include giving money to the auto industry and the banks, okay? These are things he did not want to do, that have no political upside, but that he felt he had to do. And I think history will prove that to be right. But he is still trying to make sure we lay the foundation for a stronger economic future. And let me tell you why that's hard. There are aspects of his presidency, our relationship with the rest of the world, which I think has been strengthened in many ways and changed. A lot of the things around parental involvement in education, even around some of the payment to teachers in education. A lot of things to do with, obviously, we're on track to wind down the war in Iraq. But on health care and energy, a lot of this has to go through Congress. It just has to. And this is not a case where we can get 50% of the vote for health care and it happens. Okay? And Congress, and this is something that afflicts both parties, it is a very small institution. It is a scared institution. It does short-term things. It does not do long-term things. It looks to the next election, not the next generation. Okay? It is ingrained, and it is deep, and it is both parties. And what he's asking, unfortunately, on health care, our party to do. I wish there were more Republicans. Maybe on final passage they will be. But I am not one that rues that. My view on health care is this. If our party does not get this done, we deserve what is coming to us. Yes. We deserve what is coming to us. And most people who serve in that building with the dome on it in Washington ran for some large reason that they wanted to do something about health care. This is our opportunity. As Bill Clinton, I think, very smartly put it yesterday to the Senate, there's going to be stuff in this thing all of you disagree with. And there's going to be stuff we're going to have to build on. But if we miss this moment, our country may not recover from it. So, but you're asking Congress to do things that the positive benefit of it, at least fully, will not be apparent to all voters in the next election or the one after that or the one after that or the one after that. And that's what we have to do. Because I can assure you our competitors are doing it. They are doing it right now, and they're ahead of us in many respects. So if we want to be the kind of country we all have enjoyed living in, we've got to do these tough things. So it's hard, but I think we're on the right track here. And, you know, I think that I also, you know, I don't want to be terribly partisan about this, but I think the Republicans should refrain from slapping each other on the back and breaking their elbows in the transaction because, listen, they're at historic lows right now. Okay, in the history of public polling, they have never been this low. Why are they this low? Because centrists and moderates do not feel welcome. They've left their party. They've gone to the independent party. They have catastrophic problems with younger voters, Latino voters, and African-American voters nationally. So we have an opportunity. Doesn't mean they're not going to win some elections. It doesn't mean there are a bunch of people going to have tough 2010 races because they won largely on the backs of huge turnout that's not going to be there. Hard races. And we've won basically all the House races there is to win. You know, and that's why the House Republicans aren't cooperating because pretty much none of them worry about a general election anymore, only a primary. But the way we're going to seize this, so my argument is the politics of this are not even secondary. They should be immaterial. We have to stand up and lead right now. But I think the politics of this long-term for our party could not be better. So if we can say at a moment that rivaled the Great Depression, it was our party that led us out of that economic wilderness and began to rebuild with no help from them. It was our party that did health care. And the one thing I know is that the things people are being told to fear, death panels, you won't be able to see your doctor, you're standing in line, none of it's going to happen. And health care is not going to be a spin war. Because we all witness it every day. We will come to our own conclusions very quickly what's happened. And we can say we've led on energy and we've done really smart things about education. We've changed and improved the relationship with the rest of the world. That's how we will improve this country and that's how we'll win elections. So, and I think in the next 2 or 3 months you're going to see remarkable progress on a lot of these things. But I can't tell you how hard it is. I can't tell you how hard it is, because the culture there is ingrained against big change.
There are a number of questions about the Republicans in Congress, so I'm really glad you answered it. I've done this for 20 years, and I have never had so many questions for a speaker. So I'm going to try to...
Well, ask me some softball ones.
Yeah, okay, I've got it. I got a really easy one for you here. Several people want to know, where did you come from? And what is the experience that caused Obama to know that you were the guy to help make this happen?
Well, first of all, I'd say I think there's, in our political coverage today, there's too much attention paid to operatives. You know, this is all about Barack Obama and his supporters, and we just try to service them in a smart way. You know, I got involved in politics and this is really for the students here. You know, I was, in college, cleaning chimneys, selling knives door-to-door, teaching tennis, doing anything to make money, nothing that had any... future, and I decided to work on a political campaign, answering an ad in the campus newspaper, of all things, to go knock doors in a U.S. Senate primary in Delaware. And got involved, big underdog, down 18 points 2 weeks out. We surged to win, big election victory, opponent concedes, we're off to the general election against Senator Bill Roth. Then they discover on the Monday after Saturday primary, they gave us 2,828 votes in a precinct instead of 28. So they took away those votes, and we were up 3. And then in the recount, we lost by 71. And I don't think I would have stayed in politics had that not happened, but it taught me that if any of us in that campaign had worked harder, we could have figured out a way to scrounge up another 71 votes. And so my message to particularly young people who are interested in politics is... in our country, other than the Civil War, which is admittedly a big exception, we settle our disputes not through violence, but through elections. And if you have a particular point of view about the future of your city or your county or your state or your country, the best thing you can do, unless you're going to run yourself, is to elect people who share that vision. Elections have consequences. The people who win elections have a chance, they don't always succeed, to implement their vision. I did not have a lot of tolerance for Democrats in the 8 years of George W. Bush, you know, complaining too much. I complained about his policies. He won the election. Elections have consequences. And we have to get people involved in politics. And one of the things I hope our campaign does, because I've never been more positive and confident about our future because of the young people that got involved in our campaign. Remarkably talented and selfless, have a wonderful worldview. Obviously, they understand technology in a way that I think is going to be very, very effective. These people are ready to lead in the not-too-distant future, but we've got to keep them involved. And so I hope what we see is more and more people getting involved in politics, getting involved in mentoring kids, getting involved in nonprofits, running for office themselves. And I do think this, if Barack Obama can be elected president from the outside running a grassroots campaign, I hope the message that sends to anybody thinking about running for office who doesn't come from the quote-unquote political establishment, they say, well, shoot, if he can win the presidency like that, I might be able to win a city council race or a state representative race or a congressional race. I do think we need a much higher quality and more people running for office, and so I hope the campaign helps foster that.
I think it has. But I have several questions from people about 2012, because we're already worried. And has the campaign started? And are we into a multi-year fundraising? One of the things that several of the questions say, we understand that people get elected, for example, to Congress, and the first day they go into office, they have to start fundraising, tens of thousands of dollars a day. How do we break through that, and how does the 2012 election relate to that?
The 2012 election, from our standpoint, has certainly not begun. The president has, I think, smartly kind of forbid any planning, discussion of, and I think that's right, because if you're going to make tough decisions for the country, you don't want to be doing it through the prism of 2012. So honestly, the last one just ended a year ago. There will be a time for that. It is not right now. I will confess to idly, maybe when I'm out running, giving it some thought. But I banish that from my mind by the time I'm done. So I would say this. Now, the Republican nomination fight is beginning, actually, in full earnest. And so they'll have their battle, and it'll be interesting to see, because I do think right now, to win their nomination, you have to win and run the Palin Limbaugh Beck obstacle course. And so whoever is their nominee, I think, is going to come out of it much further right than any nominee of theirs in recent history, as things stand now. The one thing I know is the campaign of 2012 will be different in many ways that I can't articulate right now. I just know it will be. And that's one thing that served us well, is we did not follow an old playbook in 08, and we won in 012. But there'll be a time for that. But now the time's to problem solve. And so we'll get... Now, 2010, listen, in Washington, everybody wants to predict what's going to happen. There's like 20 lifetimes between now and then. We ought to just let this thing play out, and we'll see where things stand in the fall. But there's no doubt that, you know, we're going to have some people have some tough elections. We've got an opportunity to win some pretty easy open seats, I think. But my view is the thing we can do atmospherically to guarantee the best possible outcome is to say we've delivered on some things. And if we don't do that, I think we're going to have a whale of a tough election.
A couple of people have expressed concern about Diebold and the election voting machines. How did that affect your thinking in the last campaign, and does that worry you for our future?
Well, it didn't. Here's what I'd say. We took election protection very seriously in the campaign. Some of you might have volunteered for us who are attorneys around the country. And we did not view election protection as an election day effort. Far from it. We tried to get ahead of problems, and in every battleground state, tried to look at the whole panoply of issues. You know, things like machines, things like additional paper ballot, things like poll workers. In a lot of states, we have a severe shortage of poll workers. Things like early vote locations. Were there enough of them? Were they evenly distributed? And so methodically, now in states where we had, you know, good elected officials, including, by the way, Republicans who actually were there to help people vote, we could actually get a lot of progress made. And so I think we eliminated a lot of problems on Election Day because of very, very good planning. But there's a lot of work still to do. We did not see a huge problem with voting machines this time at all. But there were still people whose votes weren't counted. There were still people who were challenged too aggressively on Election Day. There is an effort in Congress right now that I hope succeeds, which would make voter registration universal and close to automatic in the country, which, by the way, like every other country that's developed have, we should have that too. And so I just think generally we should try and make registration, voting, and or automatic. And we need to try and get as much early vote out there as possible, because it's clear that early vote, you guys have it here in California through the mail. The states that have early vote have higher turnout. And I think it can't just be mail, it needs to be in-person voting too. I think there's going to be a ballot initiative in Missouri next year, which hopefully will pass, which would be very important. So we as a party, and I really as a country, but as Democrats though, we also have to make sure that elections are run honestly and fairly. And there are some safeguards that we should just not reflexively oppose. There's a balance here. But I think that we didn't see many problems, but we were on top of it. And I mean, this is one thing, you know, we're already having calls about 2010 election protection because it matters. It matters. And by the way, these governor's races matter. I don't need to tell you that because you've got a big one here in California. But all of this discussion in Washington will be about Senate and House races. But, you know, Barack Obama got 365 electoral votes. And if I recall, 337 of those electoral ballots are on the ballot next year, in the form of governor's races. So aside from the governance that the people of those states enjoy or don't enjoy, it has a deep impact on our politics in 12 and the decade to come. So these governor's races out there are a huge deal.
A couple of people have asked about the fact that we have a Democratic majority of someday 60, and but we have some Democrats who feel very much like not Democrats. Is this something you've discussed with the president? Is this something that we as citizens should have any input? We're, of course, here in Northern California, so it's not quite the same, but it's clearly disturbing several people who wrote questions.
Well, I'd say this. I don't want to get too academic about this. You know, if we had 30 or 40 less seats, we obviously might not be in the majority, and maybe we would be more unified. So let's not forget that, you know, part of the issue is we are now, the Republicans are down to kind of a, almost the smallest core imaginable in the House of Representatives. So they are much more unified and most and much more ideologically homogeneous. There are very few moderates left in their party. We have very, very liberal members. We've got centrist members. We've got very conservative members. And I think that, you know, we're going to lose some House members on some votes. A lot of them, by the way, voted for the energy bill in the summer, which is a very, very hard vote. My only concern would be people who think, I think most people probably voted no out of principle, but some did out of politics, and I think they're misreading the politics, because I think you're still going to get tagged with all the negative stuff, but you're going to have a base that's going to be pretty unhappy that you didn't vote the right way. But I think that this is just something we got to navigate through. We got to navigate through, and you know, the Senate's hard because we have no margin for error. And just like in the House, we span the spectrum. And that's why, you know, the narrative out there, some people say what the president should do is say, this is my health care bill. My way or the highway. Okay, great. We get 52 votes, it fails, and we'll see in 2025 as the country economically has gone to hell. That's wonderful. That's brilliant. That doesn't work, okay? And I wish we could snap our fingers and make this happen, but we've got to get 60 votes in the Senate on health care. So that means that people are going to have to give. I have a lot of confidence that we're going to get this done. I think it's going to be hairy and it's going to be hard, but I think we're going to get it done. And I'd much rather be us than them because, you know, these in some ways are good problems to have because we are a broader party. We've won a lot more elections recently. We've rebuilt in the South. We've rebuilt in the Plains. And we have an opportunity electorally really to have a wonderful, wonderful run here. But, you know, if we don't do the right thing substantively, none of that's going to matter.
I could ask you questions all night, but I think we should stop.
We could do one more if you want.
Well, this one's a tough one then.
Oh, no.
There are several questions about Wall Street. And people are wondering about the people who are advising the president right now. And I guess there's one person wrote how angry he was that, I guess it was Goldman Sachs, had flu vaccine. But I think that is a sign of what these questions are about. Can you talk to that issue?
Well, I think that, you know, the truth is he has a range of advisors, obviously. There's some that come out of Wall Street, and there's others like Goolsbee and Bernstein who don't. And what matters here, and I've always believed this, is the person making the decisions. In this case, it's the president. And I think that, you know, his pay czar obviously came out with some fairly aggressive limitations on pay, and that creates an outrage on one hand. And some of the things he's done have created an outrage on the other end of the spectrum. And I think what he was trying to do was, we could not have the financial system collapse. And there were many moments in the fall of 08, and as we headed in 09, where that seemed like a distinct possibility. Which, by the way, it would have been worse than the Great Depression, and it would have been worldwide. So we had to do some things to try and stabilize that. And ultimately, to try and get capital flowing again to the people who create jobs, which is the private sector. I mean, let's be honest. The jobs are going to be created by the private sector. And the private sector will not create jobs again in the numbers we need until there are the conditions for growth and they have confidence. Now, we have seen a 73 or 74% increase in small business lending in the last couple of months, which is beginning to generate some movement in the small business job growth. So these are very tough things. And there's no doubt that there's been terrible behavior there. There's a sense amongst a lot of the electorate that, hey, you know, these guys, you know, were not solely responsible, but played a large role in sending the economy off the cliff, not just in this country, around the world. And now they're kind of basking in, you know, a lot of money again. And that's not right. And I think that, but you're trying to manage a very complex situation. And I think this is one of the strengths of the president is he's looking down the road, which is ultimately, how are we going to create jobs again? And this isn't a case where the economy begins to come back And the majority of jobs that have been lost, people get rehired. Many of those jobs are gone and gone for good. So we've got to create new and different jobs. And the economy was driven by consumer spending. Well, it's not going to be driven by consumer spending anytime soon, if ever again. So the economy has changed in fundamental ways. So this is really complex. And you've got to, obviously, the government can only do so much. I would argue without the recovery package, we certainly would not have grown last quarter. The jobless rate would be much worse. And even the autos, which I understand why people are upset about it, but we would have had 700,000-800,000 more people out of work and entire communities decimated. And he's going to get out of that as soon as he can. The truth is the bank's going to end up paying most of the money back, if not all, and taxpayers will gain a return on some of it. So it's complicated. And, you know, the truth is it's not a political campaign. This isn't just about what's the best messaging. This is one of his strengths, is he, and you would expect me to say this, so I understand if you're skeptical. But I will tell you, you know, I traveled him a couple of weeks ago. I'm just telling you. He did not run for the presidency because he had a pathological desire to hold the office this year or any year. He did not run for presidency to occupy that office and manage it day to day in a way that everyone would agree with everything he does. He did not run for the presidency to win re-election in 2012. He ran for the presidency because he thought the country was ignoring tough, hard choices. That is going to cause a lot of people who are with him on some and not him on others to question things. But that's what leadership is. And I just hope that I have a lot of confidence when we look back on this time, years and years from now. I won't agree with everything. You won't agree with everything. But the balance of things that were done helped manage us out of this short-term crisis. And listen, you know, if you go to Toledo, Ohio, or Anderson, Indiana, or parts of Wisconsin and Iowa, you know, unemployment's 18, 20, 24%. It's a calamity. And so we've got to make sure that we've got, you know, we're growing again and capital is flowing so we have some ability to create jobs. Because if you go to any of those communities, it's devastating to see what's happening. And so, anyway, but I have a lot of confidence that over the course of the decision making, most of you will be pleased with how all this turns out. But these are hard things. And I understand the anger. I mean, what people say is, I don't get it. You know, I've lost my job. I've lost my health care. And they're popping champagne again. You know, they're right to be angry. But then on the other hand, you do the things on compensation, and you've got all the people who say they're going to create the job say, you know, you can't do that. You know, this is anti-capitalism. So it's a tough environment. And all you can do is make your best judgments every day. And that's what I think he's doing.
David Plouffe, thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. And now one Sarah Palin question. I can't believe it.
Oh, you want to wait for a Sarah Palin question? Yeah.
Well, I'll just say this.
Sarah Palin.
Her book tour starts Monday. And even though it means she's going to sell a lot of books, I hope it lasts for 2 years.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be a good thing.
Thank you for what you did to change our country and for this fabulous book. We're going to take, the ushers will help you come up row by row. And again, you can buy more books. Make me happy.
All right. That will do it for tonight's Institute for Leadership Studies lecture with David Plouffe, the author of The Audacity to Win. He was the campaign manager for Barack Obama. He's up on the stage now to sign a few books for this packed audience. Pretty inspiring lecture. Stuart Horn signing off. This broadcast brought to you by the Institute for Leadership Studies and the Communications Department here at Dominican University of California, where we are under the direction of Melba Beals. Thanks again for joining us tonight. You've been listening worldwide to radio.dominican.edu.